It is Friday, March 9th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, President Donald Trump accepts an invitation by North Korean leader Kim Jong-un to discuss ending Pyongyang's nuclear program. We get some analysis.
There's no evidence, first of all, that there was preparation here. And second, there's nothing that the North Koreans have done to merit this.
Britain's defense minister says London is being pushed around by Russia, and we hear why vinyl records maintain their fans. It's all ahead. President Donald Trump's surprise acceptance to meet with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un by May to discuss ending the North's threatening nuclear program was met with a mixture of cautious optimism and skepticism. North Korea's neighbors welcomed Trump's decision to meet with Kim. Since the talks were announced late Thursday in Washington, U.S. lawmakers, Chinese, Japanese, and South Korean officials have embraced the development. But there's also caution over possible outcomes from the high-stakes talks. Tom Nichols is a professor of national security affairs at the Naval War College and an instructor at the Harvard Extension School. Writing in USA Today Friday, he wrote that he believes North Korea is setting a trap for Trump. He tells me why.
Talking is always better than fighting, but talking requires a lot of preparation, and there's no evidence, first of all, that there was preparation here. And second, there's nothing that the North Koreans have done to merit this except to be the rogue nation they are. Usually summits with the President of the United States are a sign of great seriousness and stature and a reward often for having good relations with the United States. I think the president, and as always, this is just my own view, I think the president has reversed the process. Usually a summit comes at the end of a long period of negotiation, not at the beginning.
How do meetings at lower levels, as opposed to a summit with two leaders of countries, how does that help pave the way for the ultimate meeting of the two leaders?
Well, a lot of things that the leaders might accidentally disagree about, and we have a lot of experience with this from the Cold War, a lot of things that the two leaders might accidentally disagree about and feel that they have to dig in about when talking directly to each other can be ironed out ahead of time by people who are far less invested in the public spectacle of a summit. That is, you know, a sticking point about something could be hammered out between two lower level diplomats and it'll never have to get to the summit table. But again, the whole idea of a summit with North Korea, it seems almost as though we're elevating North Korea to the role of China or the old Soviet Union or Russia. And I think that's in itself a mistake when they've done absolutely nothing to merit this kind of meeting with the President of the United States.
I don't believe it's been determined yet where this meeting will take place, although Kim seems to rarely, if ever, leave North Korea. And I guess there are indications that this would take place in May or maybe around May. I don't think this has been finally determined. But also, as far as a public relations situation, I mean, if, say, President Trump went to North Korea for this meeting, wouldn't that be just a big PR win for Kim?
Yes, even if this meeting has to go forth and if the president doesn't change his mind, the president going to North Korea will be a huge propaganda victory for the North Korean regime, which is really at the basis of their offer. I mean, this is not the first time they have offered to meet with a president. It's something they crave because it bestows a lot of legitimacy on the regime. And if the American president goes to North Korea, the North Koreans, you can bet, are going to spin this as the leader of the most powerful country in the world bends the knee to the leader of one of the smallest and most impoverished countries of the world.
Now, you write, though, that there could be a positive outcome if North Korea tries, say, what you call a bait and switch, and which they would backtrack from denuclearization but agree to halt indefinitely all testing and production of an ICBM in exchange for sanctions relief.
Right. I could be wrong about this, and we live in a time where predictions are always pretty hazardous. I just don't think they're going to give up their nuclear arsenal. That's not really going to be on the table. And the question is, what can they give up? Because they do want to get out of the sanctions regime. Those sanctions are biting. They want to get out from under them. They could say, look, you know, we're not going to give up a nuclear arsenal. But what we'll do is we won't build the ICBM that we're clearly testing, and we'll let you help us with, you know, dismantling that or send in inspectors to dismantle that or something. I don't think that's a very good deal, but it's better than nothing, and it's certainly better than war. So if even that much comes out of it, it might be worthwhile as long as we don't commit any number of these other diplomatic blunders that we've just been talking about.
And meanwhile, sanctions continue to be very punishing in North Korea.
It's the most heavily sanctioned country in the world. The sanctions have real bite. It's a peninsular country of 22 million people. There's not a lot of ways to get things in and out of a black market there, although they try. And so, yeah, the sanctions matter. You know, there's a lot of hunger in North Korea. And it's terrible because, of course, authoritarian governments always punish their own people first rather than the ruling circle. But the sanctions have an impact, and the regime clearly wants to get out from underneath those.
Tom Nichols, Professor of National Security Affairs at the Naval War College. Well, joining me here in the studio is social media editor Doug Bernard. So, Doug, what's trending?
Well, I think it was Mark Twain who once said that a lie can travel halfway around the world before the truth even has its shoes on. Mm-hmm. But then again, maybe he didn't say that. Maybe I'm just engaging in what social media apparently engages best in, and that is false information, or as some people use the term, fake news. There is a major new study out that's published in the journal Science that looked at 10 years of stories, controversial stories, I think upward of 126,000 stories, tweeted by 3 million users over more than 10 years. This is exclusively looking at Twitter. Twitter made an agreement with some researchers to give them access to really unprecedented amounts of information. And the news is not good. The result is essentially, it appears, at least as far as Twitter is concerned, it loves bad information. Let's see, here's what's the one statistic I found. Okay, here's just a few studies. It's a very scientific study, but I'm just going to try and translate some of the language. A false story or false information is much more likely to go viral than a real story. False stories reach about 1,500 people 6 times quicker on average than a true story does. This includes all categories: economics, transportation, entertainment. It's especially true in politics. And here's the thing. I think a lot of people over the years have said, well, it's those darn bots. You know, they're tweeting and retweeting and sending out all kinds of bad information and whatnot. Actually, the results of the study says you can't blame the bots. The bots actually, and these bots, by the term bots, these are literally sort of robots or artificial intelligences that are, you know, kind of tweeting out, you know, things that it is pre-designed to find and to send out. So obviously lots of times with a very political bent. But apparently the bots, the researchers find, retweet correct information, accurate information, just as often as they retweet incorrect information. It's humans that seem to have a special affinity for incorrect stories, for sending them out, for sharing them. Now, whether this is just because it's something that sort of confirms their bias about a particular viewpoint of a story in the news or a particular fact, maybe a topic like global climate change, the researchers weren't able to kind of really explore that too much. But the results are very clear that at least as far as Twitter is concerned, it's really kind of a bad information tool. It is not a good tool for conveying and communicating accurate information.
That's absolutely amazing. And when you think about it, so many journalists and public figures use Twitter all the time.
Absolutely. And I think this is for those of us who work in communications, who work in journalism, but those of us also who just, you know, often find themselves kind of turning to these social networks. You know, we've said it before, but here's actual proof. You know, you really cannot trust what you read all the time.
All right. Thanks a lot, Doug. That's social media editor Doug Bernard. here are some of the top news stories that are trending. A humanitarian aid from a convoy arrives in eastern Ghouta. Fears of a trade conflict arise in Asia over U.S. tariffs. The UN Human Rights Chief urges alleged crimes against the Rohingya go to the International Criminal Court. And a Taliban attack in Afghanistan kills 17 members of the forces in the northeast. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the voanews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
The 1937 disappearance of aviation pioneer Amelia Earhart as she was attempting a grueling equatorial flight to circumnavigate the world has been one of the greatest unsolved mysteries of our time. Professor Emeritus Richard Jantz of the University of Tennessee, Knoxville, conducted a forensic analysis that suggests the bones found on a South Pacific island are those of Ms. Earhart. Jantz said he analyzed the bones by using several modern techniques, including a computer program called Fordisk, which can estimate the sex, ancestry, and stature of a person from skeletal measurements. The professor found that data revealed that the bones found in 1940 are more similar to Earhart than to 99% of people listed in a large reference sample. Could it be the mystery has finally been solved? I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, records make somewhat of a comeback, at least for their fans. Britain's defense secretary is calling for retaliation against Russia as a former Russian double agent and his daughter fight for their lives after being struck down by a toxic substance. Gavin Williamson's remarks follow the apparent attempted assassination March 4th of Sergei Skripal, who was recruited by Britain's MI6 intelligence agency and his 33-year-old daughter, Yulia. Russian officials deny the Kremlin had anything to do with the assassination attempt, dubbing British allegations as hysterical and wild. Jamie Detmer tells me about Williamson's comments.
Well, he broke ranks, really, with the rest of the British cabinet, with the other British ministers, who have been trying not to, you know, point the finger and blame specifically naming Russia. He's saying the Kremlin is pushing Britain around and Britain must respond and think of different ways of dealing with this. Other cabinet ministers have been a little bit more careful and have urged, you know, people to avoid a rush to judgment. Although they have said if it is proven that foreign power was involved in this hostile activity, which is the first nerve agent attack on British soil, by the way, then they will act robustly in response.
Well, in addition to that, there was this Russian television presenter, you know, made comments, I believe, yesterday, saying traitors shouldn't think that they're safe in Britain and basically saying, if you're a professional traitor, do not go to England.
And not only a professional traitor, if you are someone who's a traitor in the sense of just criticizing the Russian government, you ought not to go to England as well, because strange things happen there, he says. My advice isn't to go there. Yes, the Russian state television, this is Channel 1, and it was said on the flagship news program, does seem to be trying to fan the political flames here. The Russian officials themselves out of the Kremlin have been denying there is any Kremlin involvement in this and saying these are wild and hysterical accusations. But there's been a pattern of about 14 deaths in the last two decades of Russian emigres or critics of the Russian government, or people who've been trying to expose corruption, official corruption in Russia, who have met rather mysterious deaths, and deaths that U.S. intelligence agencies told BuzzFeed last year that they believe had been the handiwork of the Kremlin and of the Russian intelligence services, the FSB. You have to go back, of course, to 2006, when another Russian double agent who had been recruited by MI6 and was a very outspoken critic of Putin also died, after a pretty horrific poisoning by a nuclear material. He took days to die. On his deathbed, he pointed the finger at Putin. There was a public inquiry, which 2 years ago in Britain concluded there was a strong probability that he'd been killed by Russian intelligence and that there had been approval by the Kremlin.
Well, meanwhile, Sergei Skripal and his daughter Yulia remain in the hospital in Salisbury. What is known about their condition?
Well, apparently it's still critical. They're meant to be stable now, but they're both in critical condition. We believe that they are still both in comas. A policeman who also got affected by this apparently is out of coma and is talking, and they have hopes for his recovery. In all, British police are saying 21 people were treated for possible contamination from this nerve agent, which people believe is either a form of BX or sarin. Originally, they thought that this had been sprayed or something like that at the Russian pair, the father and daughter. Now, British police, who've also called in biowarfare experts from the British Army to help them, now believe that they were impacted by, however, by spray or by ingestion at the Skripal's home in Salisbury.
Jamie Detmer reporting. This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our 5-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's Newsmaker interview program. Join us each Saturday and Sunday when we talk with authors, analysts, and policymakers who provide fresh insight on topics ranging from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. That's Press Conference USA every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
This is International Edition. Beginning in the 1950s and for the following 40 years, vinyl records were the primary medium for music and audio. Digital audio nearly wiped out production of vinyl records, but not completely. Over the years, records have been making a comeback, partly for nostalgia and partly for the artistic packaging and characteristic warm sound records seem to produce. VOA's Jim Stevenson and Top 20 Countdown host Ray McDonald remember vinyl as the annual Record Store Day approaches next month.
Just take those old records on!
Jim, both you and I have been around long enough to remember the heyday of vinyl.
Mm-hmm.
That's a nice way of saying, you know, we're
not
a
little
young
older
anymore. We're not kids. But yeah, Record Store Day is a great idea. It was started in 2007 to honor independent record retailers around the world. And it's more relevant today than ever before because vinyl sales have been on the upswing for the past several years. People really enjoy vinyl. And vinyl gives artists a chance to really get creative with their packaging and with digging into their vaults and unearthing some really cool stuff. And this year is no different. One of the highlights include a Led Zeppelin 7-inch vinyl disc featuring
a
previously unreleased mix of rock and roll and the song Friends. Zeppelin is celebrating their 50th anniversary in 2018. Jimmy Page is promising a lot of good stuff, so this, I guess you could say, is the opening shot. Sufjan Stevens, who's a really good singer-songwriter, he's giving us a 10-inch single featuring his Oscar-nominated single Mystery of Love. That was from the movie Call Me By Your Name.
Mm-hmm.
U2 will have a limited edition picture disc featuring two versions of their new song Lights of Home. That's from their latest album, Songs of Experience. Taylor Swift is getting in on Record Store Day. She will re-release her albums Fearless, 1989, and her self-titled debut disc, all on special colored vinyl. And Bruce Springsteen is going the colored vinyl route, too. He'll give us his 1995 Greatest Hits album as a double disc set on red vinyl.
Oh, I love it.
Now, there's always a particular artist who's chosen as the Record Store Day ambassador. This year, it's the rap duo Run the Jewels. And they're releasing a metal collector's box featuring several things, including a vinyl EP with remixes and instrumental tracks. They'll also throw in a special slip mat and sticker. So if you're a Run the Jewels fan, this is a chance for you to really get some swag. Rapper Nas, this sounds really intriguing. Nas, one of the best-known rappers, will drop a vinyl edition of his performance of his album Illmatic, which he did at the Kennedy Center right here in Washington, D.C., along with the National Symphony Orchestra. And that's really just the tip of the iceberg. As I said, Record Store Day is coming up on April 21st. We have several weeks lead up to it, so I'm sure there will be many other releases coming out. If you want to read more about it, I have details on my Twitter page, Ray on the Hits, and you can also go to VOA1's Facebook page, VOA1 The Hits.
We were all amazed by the clarity of CDs when they came out and how much more we heard within the music. But that warmth of vinyl just grabs you, and it hasn't gone away.
No, it hasn't. It's just a timeless appeal. There's the warmth of the vinyl sound, and there also, at least to me, is the appeal of holding a record album in your hand. Because the record album, it was like a canvas. Mm-hmm. And artists were able to do so much with it, much more so than a CD jacket, and of course, way more than today's, you know, downloads and streams, right, where you can't hold anything. I miss those days, and like I say, those days are still with us because vinyl is very, very popular.
Thanks for spinning it around with us, Ray. Check him out on Twitter.
At Ray on the Hits.
Thank you, Ray.
You got it, Jim.
Now whip out your big 10-inch. Reckon a band of players up the blues. A band of players.
And that is our show. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us. Have a great weekend.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The administrator of the U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID, Ambassador Mark Green, and the Secretary of State for the Department for International Development of the United Kingdom, Penny Mordaunt, have launched the first-ever humanitarian grand challenge called Creating Hope in Conflict. It encourages innovators around the world to submit ideas to save and improve the lives of the most vulnerable and hardest-to-reach people affected by humanitarian crises caused by conflict. The partners will invest a combined $15 million over the next 5 years to support innovations that enhance the effectiveness and efficiency of humanitarian assistance. Announced on February 19th, the initial call for innovation seeks solutions that engage the private sector to provide, supply, or locally generate safe drinking water and sanitation, energy, life-saving information, or health supplies and services to help meet the needs of conflict-affected people. The Humanitarian Grand Challenge represents a multi-governmental partnership that enables governments and the private sector to work together alongside affected communities to address the unprecedented magnitude of suffering around the world. Nearly 136 million people across 25 countries are in need of humanitarian assistance. Less than 1% of humanitarian aid focuses on investing in innovations. The Humanitarian Grand Challenge is expected to fund 10 to 15 seed projects with grants of up to $250,000 and 2 to 4 transition-to-scale projects of up to $1 million to support the refinement, testing, and implementation of solutions that have already achieved proof of concept. This is the 10th Grand Challenge supported by USAID and its partners. To date, USAID and its Grand Challenge partners have delivered grant funding and technical assistance worth more than $500 million to more than 450 innovators in 70 countries. The United States is proud to work with the United Kingdom, other international partners, and innovators around the world to meet the daunting challenge of saving lives in conflict-driven humanitarian crises.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.